and murder, and I wanted no part of it. He removed his hand from the chain. "And I want no part of this." She maintained her smile, taking the chain and amulet from the desk, and standing to move behind him. She felt him sag as she lifted the chain over his head and laid it on his shoulders, although it weighed no more than a few ounces. "Exactly, my lord." She leaned down and planted a soft kiss on his cheek, choosing to ignore his flinch as she moved back, and he rose unsteadily to his feet. "I will leave you 20,000 realm guard," she told him. "They are to crush every remaining vestige of criminality within Australian borders. All miscreants to be executed without exception under the Queen's word. I feel we have been too lenient of late. You will, however, steer clear of Cumbrailian lands unless in dire emergency or called upon by Lady Velis. I will provide a list of other priorities. Aspect Dendrish's legal reforms and the reconstruction of the city being the most pressing." She angled her head, studying the way the amulet hung around his neck, finding that his stoop had worsened a trifle. "It suits you very well, my lord." He gave the most shallow of bows, his reply tense and clipped to remove all expression. "Thank you, Highness." Orenna liked to dance in the afternoons, moving among the barren palace gardens with a joyful grace, sometimes catching hold of Muriel's hands and pulling her into a whirl, laughing her girlish laugh. Today she wore winter blooms in her hair, pale petals shining like stars in the dark mass as she spun and spun. "Sit with me," Lerna said as her dance finally came to a halt, Arena's skirts blossoming as she whirled to the ground with an exhausted but happy giggle. "I have cakes." They were in the remnants of her former hidden garden, Lerna arranging cakes alongside a porcelain tea set on the bench next to her. Arena was very fond of cakes, but continually lacking in manners, cramming one into her mouth the moment she sat down, fingers sticky with icing and cream. "Yum," she said, one of the few words she consented to speak these days, although it transpired this new Arena had little need of speech. Lerna's head momentarily flooded with the sensation of enjoyment, the texture of the cake on her tongue, the softness of the cream. She had to concentrate to clear the images, a skill learned from Aspect Canis, who advised repeating a numerical sequence as the best means of blocking Arena's wayward thoughts. "Brother Innes tells me you have not been attentive at lessons recently," Lerna told her. Arena's thoughts took on a bored weariness, swallowing the last of the cake and rolling her eyes. "Learning is important," Lerna persisted. "Don't you want to read again?" Arena shrugged, and her thoughts shifted. Joy and sunshine, the whirl of the dance. "You can't dance forever, my lady." Lerna reached out to take her hand. "I have to tell you something." A sudden wariness at the gravity in her voice, a swelling fear. "I have to go away for a time." The fear surged, and Arena's gaze went to Muriel, standing nearby, hands clasped tight and forcing a comforting smile. She found being in Arena's company a painful trial, the weight of her unconstrained gift hard to bear, especially when it chose to share memories dreadfully reminiscent of those Muriel fought to suppress. "Yes," Lerna said. "Muriel too. And Iltis and Benton." More fear, bordering on terror, a jarring sense of abandonment. Arena's hands clutched at Lerna's, a desperate plea filling her gaze. "No." Lerna forced a note of command into her tone. "No, you cannot come with us." Anger mingled with churlish reproach as Orenna snatched her hands away, averting her gaze, her face a mirror of her thoughts. "It is my hope," Lerna said, voice soft as she traced her fingers through Orenna's dark curls, "to return with a man who I think can heal you. I was selfish to let him go, but when he looked at me, looked at this face, I knew he saw that his gift had failed. I am beyond healing, but I think you are not. For your soul is so bright." Arena's features softened, her face suddenly losing all vestige of the woman-sized child she appeared to be. She met Lerna's gaze, brow furrowing, and the memories flooded forth. Lerna tried to summon a calculation to suppress the inrush of image and sensation, but the torrent was too great, overwhelming the trickle of numbers with an ease that told her Arena had been exercising much more control over her gift than they knew. The smell came first, brine, sweat, and excrement. Then the sounds, the clink of chains, the muffled sobs of despairing souls. Vision and pain arrived together, the shackles chafing wrist and ankle. The dim outline of huddled captives. She was back in the hold, a slave once more. Her panic flared, then receded, as she saw the view differed from her own memory. The steps leading to the upper deck, now seen from a less acute angle. And chained next to them, a young woman in a blue dress, her face shadowed, but the play of light on her hairless scalp revealing dreadful burns. Nevertheless, she knew this profile. She had seen it outlined against the campfire on a distant mountainside a few months before. Exhilaration mixed with malicious satisfaction in her breast, along with heady anticipation of the Allies' reward. The memory blurred, fracturing and reforming into a scene of terror, the hull splintered by the sharks ramming, screaming desperation on all sides. She saw the burnt woman standing next to the steps, key dangling from her grasp. The moment of hesitation was brief, barely noticeable, but these eyes had centuries of practice in discerning weakness, and she knew in a rush of grim understanding that this newly risen queen was about to abandon her subjects to their fate. It had been a long time since she felt anything close to wonder, but the sensation that gripped her as she watched the burnt woman return to free first the brutish brother, then the outlaw, and then, incredibly, herself, was the closest she had come for many lifetimes. The babble of thanks she offered the burnt woman as she struggled towards the steps surprised her further, for it was completely genuine. The images blurred into another memory, Harvin's scarred face poised above hers, breath mingling as their lips touched. "I'll never hurt you," he whispered, "and nor will anyone else." "You can't promise that," she whispered back. "No one can." His fingers played over the bruises on her neck, faded, but still dark enough to spoil the pleasing smoothness of this shell's skin. "I promise I'll visit bloody murder on every Valerian shit we find, just on the off chance he was the one who did this." She felt something then, something more than familiar lust, and it irked her. "Enough talking," she said, pushing him onto his back and straddling his waist. "And try to keep quiet this time." The final shift was more abrupt, as if Arena sensed her discomfort. The deck of the Sea Sabre pitched continually that day. The seas around the Wensel Isle were rarely calm. She looked up at the burnt woman and the ring she offered, wondering why the tears came so easily. Normally she had to force them, but that day they streamed unbidden from her eyes. "I think such trivia is beyond us now, my lady," the burnt woman said, and a thing that had long forgotten its own name knew then she had found a queen. Lerna gasped as the final memory slipped away, finding herself staring into Arena's apologetic eyes, an uncertain smile on her lips. "Highness?" Mural hovered at her side, touching a tentative hand to her shoulder. Lerna stood and pulled them both into an embrace, Arena clutching her waist as Mural rested her head on her shoulder. "I only ever had ladies," Lerna told them. "Never friends." Arena's thoughts gave a final pulse, heavy with a sense of regretful necessity, a lesson she barely understood but needed to share. They can change. They thronged the docks to watch her go, drowning her in a tumult of cheers and exhortations, as she ascended the gangplank to the deck of the Queen Lerna. All those not chosen to sail the ocean and finish her great crusade. The old, the young, and the skilled. Many were weeping, some openly decrying their shame and begging to be allowed to join her. A cordon of realm guard kept them back, preventing the more ardent from jumping into the harbour and attempting to swim for the ship. "Fleet Lord El Nestra," she greeted the shield as he performed a precisely formal bow. "Highness," he said in the neutral tone she found ever more grating. "The ships from South Tower and Warnsclave approach. We will rendezvous 10 miles from shore, weather permitting." She ignored the final jibe, softly spoken though it had been. He and several of his captains had voiced objections to her decision to sail so early in the year, advising the winter storms would still be raging on the high seas. He was unmoved by Brother Harlech's carefully prepared tables of historical weather patterns, indicating the northern Borelin underwent a 5-week period of relative calm during the months of Ilnasur and Onasur. "Just marks on paper, Highness," the Shield had said, casting a dismissive eye over the librarian's papers. "Udenor doesn't read." "He may not, but I do," Lerna replied. "Our enemies do not expect us until the spring, and I will not pass up an opportunity to surprise them. Our fleet will be complete within the month, whereupon we will sail, with or without you." Her gaze went to the King Malsius, unfurling sail as she cleared the mole. Beyond her, a long line of equally huge vessels ploughed towards the horizon. At the end of the mole, she could see a figure seated before a vast canvas, perched precariously on an easel. Master Benrel came to capture the scene, though the slate-grey sky and misted horizon made for a gloomy spectacle. The Shield bowed again and began calling out the orders that would see them away from the docks, the crew running to detach lines and heave the beams into place to push them from the wharf. "Wait," Lerna ordered, as her gaze found a diminutive figure at the prow. Adonis didn't look up from the contraption as Lerna approached, gently tapping a small hammer to some piping on its underside. "My lady," Lerna said.
"Highness?"
Adonis gave the pipe a final tap, smiling in satisfaction at the sound it produced. "If your work here is complete," Lerna went on, "I would ask that you go ashore." "Sadly, this new device requires more work." Alornis gave a transparently forced laugh and crouched to inspect the machine's supporting legs. "I can't possibly let it sail in such condition, Highness." Lerna went to her side, speaking in soft tones. "I gave your brother the most solemn promise that I would keep you safe. Now remove yourself to the shore, or I'll have Lord Iltis do it for you."
"They killed Alusius!"
Alornis whirled towards her, the hammer flying across the deck as she tossed it aside, face livid, her shout heralding a frigid stillness on the deck.
"You promised justice!"
Alornis's voice had taken on a strangled tone, though she forced the words out, her gaze tearful but unwavering.
"I have travelled the length of this realm, recording murder and destruction with every mile, and laboured without sleep for months to provide you these deadly instruments. All without request for reward or expectation of favour, because you promised justice, and I want mine."
"He will never forgive this," Lerna knew, "even if she lives."
"Fleet Lord Elnestra," she said, turning away, "please get us underway."
The first few days were hard, the seas high enough to rob the fleet of any appearance of cohesion. Many of the ships lost to sight in the near constant rain. At the Shield's orders, every vessel had experienced navigators on board, most of them Meldinians who could be trusted to keep an eastward bearing regardless of the weather. Even so, there were times when Lerna looked out on the shifting grey wall that surrounded them and had to suppress the feeling they were sailing alone. Below decks, Lord Norta's regiment suffered continually with seasickness and the confines of shipboard life. They had to be ferried to the top deck in relays for fresh air and exercise, most stumbling through their drills, moving with perfunctory lethargy, though Lerna's presence seemed to provide some stimulus to extra effort. The slight woman with the daggers she remembered from Ultor greeted her with a grave bow upon ascending into the daylight, the third morning out from Varenshold. Proceeding to throw herself into a series of sword drills with zealous energy before collapsing in a sudden convulsion. Her bleached white face looked up at Lerna stricken with mortification as she strode forward to help her up.
"I beg forgiveness, Highness," she stammered, "though my wretched weakness deserves no pardon."
She fell silent when Lerna pressed a hand to her forehead, finding it far too chilled and clammy.
"Guardswoman Furla," she said, "you are unwell."
Furla blinked in surprise at being addressed by name, then drew herself up to a not considerable full height. "No more than anyone else, Highness." She staggered as the ship's hull crested another steep wave,
Lerna feeling how she trembled as she reached out to steady her by the arm.
"What did you do?" she asked, "before the war?"
"My father owned a mill, Highness. I worked it with him."
"Then you are familiar with gears and machinery?"
"Had to be, Highness. After that worthless
My daughter's father was not a dutiful man, forcing us to seek refuge with my father. After a while, his hands got too gnarled for fixing things.
Come with me." She led her to the stern, where Alornis was rigging a tarpaulin over one of the ship's four ballistae. The constant rain and spume were a source of great consternation as she sought to keep her precious engines free of rust and the salt that played havoc with her various mechanical novelties.
"Lady Alornis," Lerna called to her, gesturing at Furla,
"I am appointing this guardswoman as your assistant. Please instruct her in the operation of your engine."
Alornis greeted Furla with a bemused smile.
"Thank you, Highness, but I need no assistant."
"Battle will be upon us soon, my lady," Lerna replied, "and it plays no favourites. Should you fall, it is important your knowledge not perish with you."
Alornis winced a little at the harshness of her tone, then offered her hand to Furla, who, despite her evident nausea, stood regarding the baluster with deep fascination.
"You built this, my lady?"
"I had help." Alornis took her hand and led her towards the contraption.
"Come, best if we start with the gearing."
The evening of the 10th day brought the first storm, a howling northerly gale slamming a series of ever-taller waves against the Queen Lerna's port side, eventually forcing the shield to order a turn to the south. Lerna had expected some expression of reproach as she watched him take the tiller, his hands moving with expert efficiency to steady the great vessel. But instead, he seemed oddly content, casting occasional glances at the sky and frowning in apparent satisfaction.
"It seems my calculations may have been optimistic," Lerna offered, having to shout above the wind as she moved to his side.
"You mean this?"
A spectre of his once continual grin played over his lips as he jerked his head at the roiling sky overhead.
"This is a gentle breeze compared to the Borealin's usual winter fury. It'll have blown itself out come the morning."
She lingered, seeing his reluctance to look at her, the stiffness of his shoulders.
"Why did you stay?" she asked. "I know you wanted no part of this."
"Despite my misgivings, I can't deny the wisdom in your words. If we don't finish them, they'll come again.
Better one long war than a dozen short ones, bleeding the isles white with every generation called to fight them. Besides, I made a commitment, as you may recall."
She remembered that night after the teeth, his offer of another life and the promise made beneath the stars.
"If it's any comfort," she told him, "we would never have sailed the Western Ocean together, regardless of any other developments."
He didn't turn, but she saw his shoulders slump a little.
"No," he replied,
his tone somber rather than bitter. "That day at Altor, the way you looked at Al Sorna, and I thought there was nothing else he could take from me. And your face, the face of a stranger."
"I had hoped you might see the face of a friend."
She heard him utter a faint laugh above the wind.
"Is that what you imagine the future holds for us?
Friendship?
When this war is won, you think I'll still command your fleet?
Stay at your side for all the long years of your reign?
Your faithful former pirate, your muzzled dog."
He glanced over his shoulder at her, rain coursing down his face, all vestige of his smile gone.
"I let you put me in a cage, Lerna. Don't ask me to live in it forever."
Lerna turned as Miral tugged insistently on her arm, gesturing at the door to her cabin where Iltis stood, drenched from head to toe and wearing an expression of pointed impatience.
"I strongly suggest you take shelter, Highness," the shield said, hauling on the tiller anew as another wave lifted the prow towards the sky. "Storms have no respect for rank." As he had predicted, the weather calmed over the succeeding days, allowing Lady Alornis an opportunity to demonstrate her new device. "Brother Harlech was kind enough to provide a few inspiring examples from history," she said, fitting a large set of bellows onto a copper tube protruding from the contraption's underside. The engine had been placed on the Queen Lerna's port bow, and was even odder in appearance than the baluster. A brass and iron tube some 12 feet long, bulbous at one end, tapering to a narrow spout. A large barrel sat atop it halfway along its length, and it rested on an identical base to the ballista, meaning even someone of Alonis's diminutive proportions had little difficulty adjusting its angle. Furilla stood at the thing's narrow end, fixing what appeared to be an elongated oil lamp to the spout. From the way she stood, working with arms fully extended and eyes continually straying to the barrel fixed to the device, Lerna divined her Lady Artificer's latest novelty harbored considerable potential. "There were no images to work from," Alonis went on, running a cloth over some kind of circular lever on the contraption's bulbous end. "But an Alperan text from some 600 years ago did provide a fulsome description of the machinery. The greatest difficulty was in establishing the correct mix for the fuel." "This is an Alperan device?" Lerna asked her. "Indeed, Highness. Used in a sea battle during one of their civil wars. It seems the Emperor of the day witnessed its first use and promptly outlawed it, fearing the gods might judge him needlessly cruel. They called it Revena's Lance." Revena, Lerna knew, was a principal goddess in the Alperan pantheon, guardian of the dark paths that must be traversed by every soul upon death. But Revena was a kindly goddess, and lit the paths with fire so that no good souls lost their way. However, the fire was a living thing, possessed of wisdom and insight, and would flare to engulf an unworthy soul. Lerna's heart began to beat faster as she noted the way Furla completed her task and moved back from the engine with ill-concealed haste. The lamp she had fitted to the spout now lit with a bright yellow flame. "Lamp oil is too thin," Alonis continued, working a spigot on the side of the barrel, "and burns away too quickly, so I was obliged to use base oil. Even then it required thickening with pine resin." She stood back, giving her invention a final look of appraisal before turning to Iltis and Benton. "My lords, the bellows, if you would." The two lords moved to the bellows, standing side by side to grip the large iron rod fixed to it, both raising a questioning glance at Lerna. She tried to still the rising pitch of her heartbeat and inclined her head to set them to work. It took several heaves before anything happened, but when it did, Lerna was grateful for the shout of alarm that sounded the length of the ship, as it concealed her own fearful gasp. A stream of bright yellow fire erupted from the machine's spout, arcing fully 30 feet from the ship to cascade into the sea amidst a cloud of steam. The becalmed seas had allowed much of the fleet to resume their formation, and a chorus of excited shouting could be heard from the nearby ships as the arc of fire continued to flow. "Aiming is fairly straightforward," Alonis said, manoeuvring the lance about so the arc wafted the air like a flaming fan. She signalled for Benton and Diltis to stop and turned to Lerna, the last dregs of burning oil falling behind her, smiling in expectation of royal praise. Lerna resisted the urge to wipe the sweat from her brow and kept her hands clasped together beneath her cloak, fearing so many eyes witnessing how badly they trembled. The smell of her hair burning, the searing lick of the flames as they ate her flesh. The tremble in her hands increased, threatening to spread to her arms as she continued to stare at Alonis's prideful visage. "What have I made in you?" She felt a gentle touch on her arm and turned to find the shield at her side, favouring Alonis with his broadest grin. "A remarkable feat, my lady," he said. "A weapon to win a war if ever I saw one. Wouldn't you agree, Highness?" Lerna took a breath, feeling the tremble abate as the warmth spread from his touch. "My Lady Artificer exceeds all expectations," she said to Alonis. "Do you have more of these?" "I brought sufficient components for only another 2, Highness. Perhaps, when we reach our destination, I can fashion more if the right materials could be found." "More? I'm not sure I want one." "Please proceed with construction. Fleet Lord El Nestra will decide which vessels will benefit from your mighty gift." She tried to sleep, but found herself unable to settle, squirming in her bunk and trying to force the image of the flaming arc from her mind. Finally she abandoned the attempt and went to seek out Alonis, Iltis rousing himself and following without need of any instruction. The Queen's artificer was hard at work in the corner of the hold, given over to her various novelties. Furula lay in a hammock nearby, her sleep untroubled by the gentle sway of the ship. "Her stomach seems to have adjusted to ship life," Alornis said, looking up from a length of copper tubing. "Sleep comes easier to her now."
"She is fortunate," Lerna replied. "You find her work satisfactory, I trust?"
"She's very deft and clever, Highness. Given enough time, I'm sure she'll craft some devices of her own."
Lerna sat on the bench opposite Alornis, watching her work, nimble hands shaping the copper tube as she held it over a flame to soften the metal.
"You should get some rest yourself," Lerna told her. A faint tick of discomfort passed across Alornis's brow, though she remained intent on her task.
"I find sleep often eludes me these days, Highness."
"You miss your brother and Eleusis."
She saw Alornis smother a sigh and put the tube aside.
"Is there something you require, Highness?
Don't you wonder what he would have made of this, if he would have been as fierce in his devotion to this cause as you are?"
"Eleusis was a peaceful man. It didn't save him."
"He was also a spy in service to a foreign power. Did you know that?"
"Not until recently. The slave soldier, the one set to guard him, came to me before he left with Brother Frentis. Eleusis gave him a message for me before he died. So yes, I know all about his unfortunate allegiances, and I find it does not lessen my opinion of him one whit."
"What else did the message say?"
"Words for my ears alone, Highness."
Lerna felt she could discern the contents of the freed Kuritai's message clearly enough from the guarded look in Alornis's eyes.
"Did you love him back?"
she wanted to ask, but stopped herself.
"War has changed us all," she said instead. "And I know Eleusis would not have relished seeing the change in you."
Alornis's gaze became a hard glower.
"Or in you, Highness."
"You have a choice. I was robbed of such luxury the day they took my face and came to ruin our nation. But you can still turn away. How do you imagine you'll feel when that monstrous device of yours turns men into living torches? The cries of a burning man are not an easy thing to hear."
"You have asked all of us to bear many burdens. I'll not shirk mine."
"I will send you back the moment we land," Lerna decided as Alornis returned to her work. "I should never have brought you. The realm has no need of one more twisted soul, however skilled."
She raised her head as a shout sounded through the decking above, soon followed by a tumult of booted feet and the rapid pounding of the bosun's drum calling all hands to arms.
"What is it?" Alornis asked.
"An enemy ship."
Lerna rose and made for the steps to the upper deck. "Perhaps we'll have an early opportunity to see your novelties at work."
Crewmen ran to their stations, weapons in hand, whilst archers climbed the rigging with bows on their backs. The deck below her feet thrummed with the din of Lord Norta's regiment readying itself for battle. She found the shield at the starboard rail, eyeglass trained on something to the south.
"How many?" Lerna asked, moving to his side and peering into the gloom, finding only the faintest smudge some miles distant. The sky had brightened somewhat, still dim and thick with cloud, but there was enough light to reveal the horizon.
"One," he replied, and pointed to a smaller Maldinian vessel a half mile away, sails full and wake bright about her hull as she ploughed towards the newcomer. "I've signalled the Orca to investigate."
Lerna glanced at the prow where Alornis and Furla were busy readying the ballista, and resisted the urge to order her below.
"A patrol ship?" she asked El Nestra. "Most probably, though they're too far out for this time of year." It took perhaps a half hour's tense waiting as the Orca faded into the misted horizon before the shield gave a satisfied grunt and lowered his spyglass.
"The Orca hoists the signal for a capture prize and requests we come alongside."
"Then do so."
The shield's orders sent men hurrying to haul sail, and it wasn't long before the Orca came into sight. Her sails lowered as she wallowed next to a dark-hulled Valerian freighter, held close by numerous lines and boarding ladders. Lerna could see several Maldinians on the Valerian's deck, standing over a short line of kneeling captives, all grey-clad with one exception.
A red-clad, Lerna wondered as the captive's appearance became clearer, in the middle of the ocean with no escort. "Have that one brought aboard," she told the shield, pointing to the red-clad, who she now saw was of somewhat ragged appearance, his robes dishevelled and face grey with stubble and fatigue. Peering closer, she found a familiarity to his features, a resemblance to another red-clad who had the misfortune to find himself in Meldinian hands. "And signal the ship carrying Aspect Canis," she added. "I have need of one of his brothers." "How old are you?" The red-clad stared back at her with dull eyes, features slack with fatigue. She had ordered him taken to her cabin, where he sat slumped in a chair, with Iltis standing at his back. Brother Varian of the Seventh Order stood near the door, a thin young man, with a nervous smile, who had only managed the barest mumble of acknowledgement at Lerna's greeting, before bowing with such haste he nearly fell over. She could only hope his awe didn't affect his gift. As the red-clad continued to stare silently, Iltis put a large hand on his shoulder, leaning down to speak softly in his ear. "Answer the queen, or I'll skin your hide before the pirates throw you to the sharks." From the red-clad spasm of anger, Lerna deduced his understanding of realm tongue to be more than adequate, though he spoke in Valyrian. "Older than you can imagine," he said, his voice the cultured vowels of the Valyrian ruling class. "Oh, I think not," Lerna replied in realm tongue. "And speak in my language, if you please. As to your age, from what your sister told me, I estimate you to be somewhere over 300 years old." His gaze regained some spark of life at the mention of his sister, though he gave no reply. "Honored citizen Fornella av Entril av Tokrev," Lerna went on. "She is your sister, is she not? And you are Councilman Arklev Entril, whose son I had the pleasure to kill some months ago," she added silently. "You hold my sister?" he asked, dropping into heavily accented but understandable realm tongue. "Not at present, though she was well when last I saw her, if slightly aged. Where is she? You seem to misunderstand the purpose of this meeting, Councilman. We are not here so I can answer your questions. Quite the opposite, in fact. And our first order of business is to establish why a member of the Valyrian ruling council comes to be so easily captured on the high seas." Arklev slumped further, weariness and defeat plain in the sigh that escaped him. "There is no ruling council now, just the ally and the Ulvera he chooses to name Empress." Lerna glanced at Brother Varin. He had been carefully instructed in his role, though his hands shook a little as he touched a single finger to his wrist. "Ulvera means witch or sorceress, as I recall," Lerna said. "The name began with her. She earned it well." A faint glimmer of defiance crept into his eyes as he raised his head. "You met her the day she had her creature kill your brother." Lerna fought down the anger, and the instant flood of horror-filled memories. Anger is dangerous here, she knew, provoking unwise action when so much can be learned. "Brother Frentis killed her," she said. "Merely the destruction of an old shell. Now she has a new one. And this creature alone has seized your empire?" "She does the Allies' bidding. It seems he has decided the council was superfluous to his needs." "They were killed?" He lowered his gaze and nodded. "And yet you survive." "I was delayed on a business matter the day she struck. Her curatai were everywhere in Volar, killing all who served the council, every servant, slave, and family member. Thousands purged in a single day. I managed to flee to the docks. My family owns many ships, though there was only one in the harbour, and we were obliged to sail with scant supplies. The ship was half-wrecked by a storm 3 days ago." Lerna saw Brother Varin stiffen, and gave him a questioning glance. His nerves clearly hadn't abated, but there was a certainty in his movements as he touched his wrist, this time with two fingers. "I assume," she said, turning back to Arklev, "this new empress is fully aware of our intentions." "Your invasion was expected in the summer. She gathers forces at the capital and calls the remaining fleet there. It was the Allies' plan to sail out to meet you with 1,000 ships and all the troops we could muster. It seems he becomes impatient and keen to see an end to any more frustrations." Lerna's gaze flicked to Varin's hands, finding he was once again touching his wrist with two fingers instead of one.
"I realize I have been remiss," she said to Arklev, gesturing at the young brother, "in not introducing Brother Varin of the Seventh Order, a young man with a very useful ability. Brother, please relate what lies this man has told me."
Varin coughed, flushing a little and speaking in slightly tremulous tones.
I believe he was present when the council fell. He lied about running to the docks and taking ship. He lied about the plan to counter the invasion."
"Thank you, brother." She looked down at Arklev, finding him now tense with fear, but also a determined defiance, glaring back at her, jaw set and mouth firmly closed.
"Lord Iltis," Lerna said, "remove this man's robe."
Arklev tried to fight, flailing at Iltis with his manacled wrists, only to be cuffed to the deck and pinned with a knee pressed into his back. The Lord Protector ripped the robes from his back in a few seconds, revealing an intricate pattern of fresh scars covering his torso from waist to chest. Lerna turned to her white-faced brother Varin, who blanched a little under her gaze, edging away a little.
"Please fetch Lady Devoka," she told him. "She will know what to bring."
Chapter 10. Frentis. The Varicum sat on a low hill, a squat stone fortress of five interconnected circular bastions. They had been obliged to wait for 3 days in the hills to the south for a caravan to appear, 20 wagons bearing supplies and fresh slaves for training. It was well protected, with a mix of mounted Varitai and free sword mercenaries. Fortunately, it appeared news of the Red Brothers' favoured tactics hadn't made it across the ocean, because they reacted with all predictability to the sight of a cluster of terrified slave girls stumbling along the road. Whoever had command of the convoy's guard promptly sent his free swords galloping to investigate without bothering to properly secure the column's flanks. Frentis waited until the free swords surrounded the girls, watching as Lemira tearfully related the tale of her poor murdered master, collapsing to her knees from the terror of it all. The free sword leading the riders made the mistake of dismounting to pull her upright, taking hold of her head and turning it side to side in appraisal, then staggering back as her hidden knife came free to slash his neck open. The archers accounted for the remaining free swords, a cloud of arrows arcing down from the surrounding rocks to claim them, the girls falling on those still living as they lay in the road, daggers rising and falling in a frenzy. Frentis led Ilion's group of freed slaves on foot against the convoy's flank, Slasher and Blacktooth bounding on ahead to each drag of Varitai from the saddle. The column's fate was sealed when Master Rensiel and their dozen mounted fighters charged against its rear, quickly dispatching the remaining defenders. The convoy's overseer was the last to fall, a typically hulking figure standing atop the lead wagon, his whip cracking viciously as he lashed at the circling riders with no apparent sign of fear. Ilion ducked under his whip to leap up onto the wagon, slashing his feet from under him and deftly tugging the whip from his hand as he fell. In the Martiche, they had always endeavoured to take any overseers alive. Newly liberated slaves tended to appreciate it. The slaves numbered over 30 people, mostly men, sitting shackled in caged wagons in the centre of the column. There were also half a dozen women, chosen for youth and strength. "The spectacles are more popular when they offer a certain variety," Lekran explained. "It's a tradition to match women against beasts in honour of ancient myths. The Valerians discarded their gods, but kept much of their stories, especially the bloody tales." Frentis was gratified to find most of the slaves were realm folk, with some dark-skinned Alpirans from the Southern Empire. From the treatment meted out to the overseer, it was also clear they would make willing recruits.
"You did well," Frentis told Lemera, crouched over the body of a free sword as she divested it of any useful or shiny items.
She replied with a shy smile, which faded into a wince at the overseer's scream. "Freedom is a hard road," Frentis told her, before going to find 34.
"You are content with your part in this?"
Eight glanced at his two fellow former Varitai and nodded. The days since their liberation had seen them suffer through many hours of sleepless pain as the absence of Khan took its toll. However, it had also brought a new light to their eyes, plus a tendency to stare at the sky or the landscape, as if seeing them for the first time. They spoke little, and Frentis had begun to wonder if they truly understood their situation, but now saw an awareness in their gaze, as well as a sense of certainty. "We will free as many Varitai as we can," Frentis went on, "but we cannot free all. You understand this?" Eight nodded again, speaking slowly, his voice raspy and the words formed with deliberate care. "We were dead. Now we are alive. We will make others live." "Yes." Frentis lifted the sword taken from a fallen Varitai and handed it to Eight. "Many others." 34's brief discussion with the Overseer revealed the Varicum to be protected by no less than 60 Varitai, supplemented by a dozen Overseers. Fortunately, they were largely devoted to internal defense, with no more than a handful set to guarding against an incursion. "Garrisai are notoriously difficult to keep," 34 advised. "They are never given drugs, and are not bound like Kuritai." "How many can we expect to free?" Frentis asked. "The Overseer estimated over 100. But you should not expect all to be willing recruits, brother. Or easy to command. Life in the Varicum is brutal and short. Many perish in training, and fewer still survive their first experience of the spectacles. It's not uncommon for Garrisai to be driven mad by their trials." Frentis glanced at Master Renciel, sitting on the ground nearby with a vacant expression that always seemed to grip him in the aftermath of a battle. "Then they'll be in good company." He had Lekran play the role of the Overseer, clothed in black with whip in hand. Frentis and Master Renciel had donned the garb of free sword mercenaries and rode alongside the lead wagon as it ascended the slope to the Varicum's main gate. The establishment's lack of preparedness was evident in the fact it was already open, a large man striding forth to greet them with a harsh glower. "You fuckers are late," he snarled at Lekran, then paused with a suspicious frown. "Where's Master Ek?" "If the old women in my village are to be believed," the former Kuritai said, standing to unsling his axe from where it was hidden beneath his jerkin, "suffering 1,000 years' torment beyond the endless sea, you can greet him there." The Overseer was still wearing a baffled expression as the axe swept down to cleave his skull. Frentis spurred his horse forward, sword drawn as he galloped through the gate, cutting down another Overseer trying desperately to haul it closed. Two Varitai rushed forward from a shadowed doorway, short swords drawn back, then rolled under the hooves of Master Renciel's horse as he rode them down. Frentis dismounted, falling in beside Lekran as he came charging past, axe in hand, the three former Varitai close behind, along with all the fighters in their small army, Frentis having seen little point in moderation now. According to a prearranged plan, their force divided as it reached the inner keep, Lekran taking half the force right, whilst Frentis went left. Resistance was sporadic but fierce, three or four Varitai at a time attempting to block their path, but soon overwhelmed by the onslaught. Eight, together with Weaver and his two freed Varitai, had been given the role of capturing as many alive as possible. Weaver would loop his thick rope around one and drag him to the ground whilst the others closed in to bind him. Their success was small, only 7 more captured alive by the time the Varicum fell, its elegant curving marble hallways liberally streaked with blood from end to end. Frentis ordered Ilion's group to scour the Varicum for survivors, then sent Draker and his disguised realmfolk to the battlements with instructions to give every appearance that business here continued as normal. He made his way to the wide sand-covered circle in the center of the main keep, finding a dense knot of men and women standing in a defensive formation. They had arranged themselves in 3 tight, disciplined ranks, faces set and grim with defiance, although their weapons consisted of only wooden short swords and spears. The sand around them was littered with the bodies of their overseers, cut down by the archers who had occupied the balcony overlooking the arena. It seemed their attack had caught the Varicum in the middle of its afternoon practice. "They think we're bandits on a slaving expedition," Lekran commented as Frentis entered the circle, finding it hard to convince them otherwise. Frentis sheathed his sword and strode towards the group, seeing how they tensed at his approach, his eyes picking out the scars they bore. It appeared none had escaped injury, either from the whip or whatever torments the veterans had suffered in the spectacles. He halted 10 paces short, scanning for some semblance of recognition among the faces, but seeing only suspicion. "Are there any here from the Unified Realm?" he asked in Realm tongue. The response was mostly a series of baffled glares, though one did stir at the words. A light-skinned man, slightly older and even more scarred than the others. Like all of them, his head was shaven, and he wore a loose shift that revealed a body honed to the kind of leanness that only came from years of hard training. "Last of the landbound died 2 days ago," he said in a Meldinian accent. He cocked his head at Frentis, mouth twisting in faint contempt. "They rarely last long." One of the others spoke up, a short but well-muscled young woman holding a wooden spear level with Frentis's eyes. "Tell him if he intends to sell us, he better be prepared to bleed for the privilege," she said in Valyrian. "I speak your language," Frentis told her, raising his hands, palm open. "And we come only to free you." "For what?" she replied, her glower losing none of its intensity. "That," he told her, "is surely for you to decide." In all, some 2 dozen of the freed Garrisai opted to leave, the Meldinian among the first to depart. "No offence, but a pox on your rebellion, brother," he said in an affable tone at the gate, hefting a sack laden with sundry valuables and provisions. "Done 2 spectacles, and that's enough blood for any life. I'm taking myself to the coast, where I'll find anything that floats and sail to the isles. Expect my wife's probably found another winning prick by now, but still, home is home." "Your people are allied with us," Frentis pointed out. "The shiplords have agreed a formal treaty." "Really? Then a pox on them, too." He gave a brief grin of farewell, and started off towards the west at a steady run. "Coward," Lecrin muttered. "Or the wisest man I've met in a long time," Frentis thought, watching him go. The young woman from the practice ground had been elected to speak for her fellow Garrisai, and named herself as Ivelda. Frentis divined a certain tribal enmity from the hard looks and similar accent she shared with Lecrin. "She is Rotha," he had advised, his gaze darkening. "They cannot be trusted." "Othra means snake in our tongue," she replied, her hand closing on the short sword she had claimed from the pile of captured weapons. "They drink the piss of goats and lie with their sisters." "If you intend to kill each other," Frentis said as Lecrin bridled, finding himself too weary to intervene, "do it outside." He turned his gaze to the map 34 had laid out in the luxurious apartments where the Varicum's chief overseer once made his home. Much to the annoyance of the freed Garrisai, they had failed to take him alive, though great play had been made of his corpse, his head now adorning a spear thrust into the centre of the practice ground. "The Valyrian garrison will no doubt have word of our activities by now," 34 said, tapping an icon some 15 miles northwest of the Varicum. "It won't be hard to follow our trail here." "Our full strength?" Frentis asked. 217. "Not enough," Lecrin said. "Craven sister fucker," Ivelda said with a scornful laugh. "Each Garrisai here is worth 10 Varitai. "He's right," Frentis said. "We need more fighters." "If they come here, they'll have to assault the walls to take us," Draker pointed out. "Evens the odds a bit." "We can't linger, much as I'm tempted to. Besides, putting this place to the torch gives a clear signal of our intentions. Perhaps even a rallying call to those in bondage." His finger tracked to a cluster of hills 30 miles northeast, the route liberally marked with plantations. "We'll turn to face them there, hopefully in greater numbers. Be ready to march in an hour." They raided 4 plantations in as many days, their ranks swelling with every attack. The landholdings were larger farther inland, richer in slaves, and ample evidence the overseers indulged in a level of cruelty even greater than they had seen on the coast. The bulk of their new recruits were still realm folk, those born into bondage proving the least willing to forsake a lifetime of servitude, in some cases even striving to defend their masters. This had been particularly evident at the 4th plantation, where the most loyal slaves had formed a protective cordon around the owner, a tall grey-haired woman dressed head to toe in black, standing with straight-backed and flint-eyed defiance as her villa burned around her. The slaves protecting her were unarmed, but had linked arms, refusing to budge despite Frentis's entreaties. "Our mistress is kind and does not deserve this," one of the slaves told Frentis, a woman of matronly appearance, garbed in cloth noticeably less threadbare than most slaves they had encountered. Her fellow slaves were also similarly well attired, and he saw little evidence of any scars. This plantation was also unusual, in being the only one so far where they had failed to find a single overseer, and featured only four poorly maintained varietai, all but one easily captured. Frentis looked at the woman in the center of the cordon, seeing how she avoided his gaze, stoic in refusing to acknowledge an inferior. "Your mistress has grown wealthy on your labor," he told the matronly woman. "If she is so kind, why doesn't she free you? Come with us, and know freedom." It did no good. They all stood in place and proved deaf to any further persuasion. "Kill them, brother," one of the realm folk said, the former blacksmith from their first raid, snarling as he spat at the cordon of slaves. "They betray us with this disgusting civility." There was a growl of agreement from the other slaves, and he noticed, not all of them realm folk. The freed fighters were becoming more fierce with every raid, each overseer or master they tormented to death seeming to stoke a greater bloodlust. "Freedom is a choice," he told them. "Gather up these supplies and prepare to march." The blacksmith grunted in frustration, pointing his sword at the straight-backed mistress. "What about the old bitch? Put an arrow in her, and they might see sense." He staggered as Ilion appeared at his side and delivered a swift punch to his jaw. "This enterprise is under the command of the Sixth Order," she told him, "and the Order does not make war on old women." A hand went to her sword as he rounded on her, spitting blood. "Question Brother Frentis again," she continued, voice flat and unwavering, "and we'll settle this with steel. Now pack up and move." That evening, Frentis watched as Weaver freed the captured varietai. They had rested for the night on a rise 10 miles north of the old woman's villa, the varietai now numbering some 30 individuals, establishing their own camp at a short remove from the main body. They remained a mostly silent group, uniform in the expressions of wonder and curiosity with which they regarded the world, and rarely venturing far from Weaver, reminding Frentis of newborn fawns clustering around a parent. The three captives sat in the center of their group, stripped to the waist, and impassive as Weaver crouched at their